Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, an EF1 tornado with winds up to 95 miles an hour carved a nearly 16-mile path through Broome and Delaware counties over the weekend, leaving behind downed trees and widespread power outages. We'll have the latest. Pennsylvania election officials are pushing back against renewed claims of widespread non-citizen voting, while a new study finds young people are registering to vote at the lowest rates in years. We'll talk with Vote BPA about what's fact, what's fiction, and what these trends could mean for the 2026 midterms. Plus, one Upper Delaware woman is preparing to swim 10 miles in open water, not for a medal, but to raise money for free community programs and conservation, cocktails, and conversation. All coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Libby Casey. The U.S. Department of Defense says another service member has been killed in the war with Iran, and it has identified two other casualties of an Iranian attack in Jordan Friday. NPR's Jane Arraf has details.
Central Command says a service member was killed in a controlled detonation of an Iranian drone in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. And the Pentagon announced the names of two military personnel killed in an Iranian missile strike Friday on an airbase in Jordan. It said they were First Lieutenant Tyler James Feehan, 25, of Ava Beach, Hawaii. Private Isabella Gonzalez of Carrollton, Texas, died a day later. She was 19. Both were with Air Defense Artillery Regiments. The U.S. military says 17 service people have now been killed in the war with Iran. Iran says about 3,000 Iranians have been killed, many of them civilians. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
The United Kingdom has a new prime minister. Andy Burnham took office today, replacing Keir Starmer, who was ousted by his own centre-left Labour Party. NPR's Lauren Frayer reports from London.
In his first speech as Prime Minister, Andy Burnham acknowledged that he is the seventh occupant of 10 Downing Street in a decade and said he wants to restore confidence in this country.
Britain needs to show the world that we can regain our stability once again.
He pledged to, quote, re-industrialize Britain, build more public housing, end what he called rough sleeping, homelessness, and announce plans Tuesday to address rising costs of living. His predecessor Starmer said he's giving Burnham his full support as he reverts to what they call a backbencher in Parliament. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, London.
Maine Democrats are entering the final stretch to nominate a new candidate to challenge Republican Senator Susan Collins this November. A frontrunner has emerged to replace Graham Plattner, who dropped out of the race this month after being accused of rape, which he denies. Maine Public's Steve Missler reports.
Former Maine Senate President Troy Jackson held a commanding lead of delegates after the weekend's party caucuses. While those delegates aren't bound to Jackson, most have already said they'll back him at this coming Saturday's nomination convention. Should he secure the nomination, Jackson will push a progressive platform championed by his longtime ally, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. The 58-year-old logger has been involved in Maine politics for more than 20 years and has become a strong ally of labor unions and activists, many of whom were elected as convention delegates over the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Steve Missler in Sanford, Maine.
Vice President J.D. Vance and Second Lady Usha Vance have welcomed their fourth child, a boy named Alec Neil Vance. He is the first baby born to a sitting vice president in more than 150 years. This is NPR News. About a half dozen states in the U.S. remain under air quality alerts today because of smoke from wildfires in Canada. Mayan Silver with member station WUWM says states in the Midwest are primarily the ones being affected.
Fires continue to burn up in Ontario, Manitoba, and parts north and west in Canada. In places close to the wildfires like Minneapolis and Duluth, as well as the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, are going to continue to deal with degraded air quality. But Andrew Quigley, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, says due to a cold front with potential storms coming through the region, other areas will get some relief.
If you're in Wisconsin, if you're in, you know, Illinois, Indiana, lower Michigan, we're going to see those air quality alerts start to improve here, particularly as we get, you know, into the Tuesday, Wednesday time frame.
In parts of Michigan and Minnesota with poorer air quality, people with sensitivities should consider rescheduling their outdoor activities or wearing an N95. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Milwaukee.
Defaults on student loans have surged across the United States, reaching record levels. Around 9.5 million people, that's one in five federal student loan borrowers, are in default. The numbers have spiked since payments started coming due again following a lengthy pause intended to provide relief during the COVID-19 pandemic. An analysis by the Associated Press found that states with the highest concentrations of defaulted borrowers are in the South. Being a few months behind can hurt credit scores, but entering default, which is more than 9 months behind payments, can result in garnished wages or Social Security payments. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Recovery continues today in the Hancock area after Saturday evening's severe storms spawned an EF1 tornado that carved a nearly 16-mile path from Sanford and Broome County to Hancock in Delaware County. Village Mayor Sean Shannon has lifted the village of Hancock's state of emergency, allowing travel to resume, but the town of Hancock remains under a state of emergency because of extensive tree damage and downed power lines that continue to make travel difficult. Officials are urging residents to use caution, avoid downed trees, any damaged structures, and never approach downed power lines as utility crews continue restoring access and electricity. About 1,100 people in Delaware County are currently without power, according to NYSEG, and around 2,200 people in Broome County are without power. The National Weather Service in Binghamton has confirmed that the tornado reached peak winds of 95 miles an hour, damaging homes, outbuildings, and hundreds of trees before lifting southeast out of Hancock. The same storm also produced a powerful microburst near Rock Valley with estimated winds of 105 miles an hour. To help us understand what happened and what lessons we can take away from this event, we're joined by Ben Lott, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Binghamton. Ben, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Ben, first, what did your damage survey find, and what can you tell us about this tornado that tracked from Sanford all the way to Hancock?
Yeah, so they started out at Sanford, just south of there, actually, and found some tree damage, evidence of a EF0 tornado. So it started out as a weaker tornado, but then as they moved to the south east towards Hancock, they started seeing more and more damage and saw damage that would represent an EF1 tornado. So it did strengthen at some point to an EF1. And a lot of the damage was just trees that were knocked down, but especially around the Hancock area, I know that there was some personal property damage as well.
How unusual is it to see a tornado of this strength in the Catskills and Southern Tier?
Yeah, not that unusual. Most of the tornadoes, especially in New York, are generally on the weaker end of an EF0 or EF1. So during the summertime when we do have severe weather, if we were to see a tornado, it usually is on the weaker end.
And we heard in the forecast over the weekend that thunderstorms, rain possible on Saturday. What atmospheric conditions came together Saturday evening to produce a tornado?
Yeah, we just had warm, moist conditions, which provides a favorable environment for thunderstorms to develop. And what really triggered the thunderstorms that produced the tornado down near Hancock was a strong cold front that moved through and helped really kick off these storms throughout the area.
Now, after a tornado happens like this, the National Weather Service does a damage assessment, and your survey notes the tornado was on the ground for nearly 16 miles. What stood out to your team during the damage survey about this particular tornado?
The length of the tornado was certainly one of the longer ones we've seen in recent years, and probably just the damage path of the amount of trees that they had seen along the path here. I think that's what they were pretty impressed by.
The tornado appeared to strengthen, weaken, and then strengthen again before lifting off. Is that common behavior for tornadoes?
Yeah. For a lot of the tornado surveys that we do for anything stronger than EF0, it is common for us to see damage evident of a weak tornado and then it potentially strengthening and then either weakening or remaining a little bit stronger before it lifts.
Fortunately, there were no injuries or fatalities. There are reports of trees falling onto some homes and even a vehicle. This same storm also produced a 105-mile-per-hour microburst near Rock Valley. Many people hear these terms used interchangeably. What's the difference between a tornado and a microburst?
Yeah, so a tornado is, a swirling of wind. It's a funnel that extends from the storm all the way down to the ground. It's something that you're going to see if you happen to catch it. A microburst is just a lot of wind coming down in a small area. Sometimes you can see these because there's often rain and hail within a microburst. But it's usually just a quick downburst of wind in a relatively small area.
How can your survey teams tell after the fact whether damage was caused by rotating winds from a tornado or the straight line winds from a microburst?
Yeah, we are trained to look at the damage and get an assessment of what may have caused, especially like tree damage or downed wires. Typically with a tornado, we'll see kind of trees laying in different directions. With like straight line winds or a microburst, they are typically all laying in a similar direction. Every once in a while you can get damage that may look like a tornado, but it was actually a microburst. And we also use a combination of radar as well. We'll review radar and get kind of a rough idea of where we think a tornado was possible, and then maybe where straight line winds were more than likely the reason for the damage.
Were there tornado warnings in place before this tornado touched down, and how much lead time did residents have?
Yeah, so this storm was warned. Those closer to the start path had less lead time than those that would have been near the end of the path.
And what do you think people need to understand about tornado warnings in our area? I think some people think of tornadoes mainly as something that happens in the Midwest and the plains.
Yeah, anytime that you receive a tornado warning, you should seek shelter in a sturdy building on the lowest level. So if you have a basement to go to, that's going to be the lowest level that you'll want to go to. However, not everyone may have a basement, so if you are on the main level, try to find an interior room away from exterior walls. Typically, that can be a bathroom or even a closet. You just want to put as many walls between you and the outside as possible.
What if you're outside, on the river or an outdoor event, or you're driving, common in the summer? What's the safest thing to do if you receive that tornado warning in that case?
Yeah, again, if possible, you need to seek shelter in a sturdy building. So if you are doing outdoor activities, you need to end those immediately and take cover. And it's always important to be aware of the potential for severe weather and having a plan in place in case you are trying to do, whether outdoor activities, whether you're out on the river or even driving in a vehicle. Just being aware of the forecast can help you plan if a warning were to pop up over your location.
More severe weather predicted tomorrow afternoon and evening. What should folks be looking for as more strong to severe thunderstorms move through the area?
Yeah, we're looking at something similar to what we saw on Saturday. The main concern with the severe weather for Saturday are going to be damaging wind gusts, so very strong winds that could produce widespread or localized damage like we've seen. But we can't rule out some large hail and maybe even a tornado or two for tomorrow.
And tomorrow, that's tomorrow afternoon and evening. Right now, it's just a hazardous weather outlook. No watchers or warnings yet.
Yeah, correct. We are only outlooked for severe weather right now If we were to have any watches issued, those would be issued sometime tomorrow once we have a better idea of what the environment's looking like and what kind of hazards may be possible.
How heavy the rain is, how fast it's moving, whether there could be flash flooding, all of that.
Correct. Yep.
And before we let you go, we heard in NPR News headlines about some relief for some of the smoke from wildfires in Canada and Minnesota. Is that looking like that trend is going to continue, that there won't be as much of an impact this week?
Yeah, certainly, you know, for at least the next couple of days, we are not seeing any high concentrations of smoke in the area. Now, for the rest of the week, the overall weather pattern, you know, does kind of put us in an area where smoke from Canadian wildfires might be able to make it back down into the northeast. But as of right now, we're not seeing any signs of any hazardous smoke, at least in the upcoming days.
That's Ben Lott, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Binghamton. Ben, thank you so much for that update, and we will stay attention, pay close attention as these other severe storms move through the area. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
And a reminder that in Hancock, the village of Hancock has lifted the state of emergency, allowing travel to resume, but the town of Hancock remains under a state of emergency because of that extensive tree damage and down power lines that continue to make travel difficult. Still to come, separating election myths from election realities. We'll talk to VoteBeat PA on the latest dispute between state election officials and the Justice Department and why fewer students are registering to vote. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org, and from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
Researchers estimate that tens of thousands have died in Africa due to cuts in U.S. foreign aid. In Nigeria, life-saving drugs once funded by USAID are now much harder to access.
It started like a normal sickness. He had fever, weakness, and was not eating well.
I'm Elsa Chang. We hear from Nigerian families who have been affected on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Pennsylvania election officials are once again pushing back against false claims about widespread non-citizen voting, even as the Trump administration has renewed its focus on election integrity ahead of the 2026 midterms. At the same time, a new study finds young people are registering to vote at some of the lowest rates seen in years, raising fresh concerns about civic participation. Carter Walker covers elections for VoteBeat PA and joins us to separate fact from fiction and explain what these developments could mean for voters in the Commonwealth. Carter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I wanted to start out about this, you know, election integrity question. You've been reporting on the renewed claims of President Trump and the Justice Department about non-citizen voting. What happened over the past week, and why is Pennsylvania at the center of this conversation?
Yeah, so last week, President Trump held a primetime briefing where he addressed the nation on what he said was going to be an issue of election security. And what he did, as I'm sure many of your listeners saw at this point, was rolled out some accusations about China attempting to interfere in our elections and some other stuff, and then tacked on at the end this, by the way, the Department of Homeland Security has done this analysis of poor states' voter rolls and found 250,000 non-citizens on the voter rolls. So Pennsylvania was one of those four states. But there's still a lot of questions on exactly what they found, the methodology, and, you know, if it's accurate.
And, you know, he alleged these vulnerabilities that exist in the American election systems. However, declassified documents by his own administration contradict that. Meanwhile, Pennsylvania Secretary of State Al Schmidt has strongly disputed the suggestion that non-citizens are voting in significant numbers. What's the evidence he's pointing to, and how unusual is it to see a Republican election official publicly challenge claims coming from the Republican administration?
Yeah, well, it's becoming increasingly more unusual, unfortunately. You remember back in 2020, there were a lot of state and local Republicans, Al Schmidt being one of them, that pushed back against the Trump president's claim there, but a lot of them are out of office now. But what the secretary here has said is, I mean, you know, he's not one who's going to say that there's no non-citizens on our voter rolls because we don't have a national citizenship database in this country. So that always leaves the possibility that a couple are going to slip through the cracks. And Secretary Schmidt himself, in fact, has found some of those people when he was a commissioner in Philadelphia and even referred some of them for prosecution now that he's been our secretary. But basically what he said is what the evidence has shown over the years, excuse me, that this does happen in very, very small quantities. Sometimes a couple of them slip through and do get on the rolls, but all evidence shows that it's very rare. So his response to the Justice Department the Department of Homeland Security wasn't entirely dismissive. It said, you know, please show us your evidence and your homework. And you know, if this is true, we'll work with you. But he made it clear that from his experience, this is a minor issue.
What safeguards already exist to prevent non-citizens from registering or voting in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, well, the number one safeguard is that it's illegal. If you're a non-citizen and you register to vote, you can be prosecuted for that crime, and people do all the time. The biggest downside it carries for them is that if you are, you know, applying for citizenship and you get convicted or charged with that, you're probably not going to become a citizen and will most likely be deported to your country of origin. Election officials do ask for your Social Security number or your driver's license number when you register to vote. Of course, not everybody in the United States who is a citizen has one of those. There are some communities, religious communities, that don't have Social Security numbers, don't have driver's licenses. So that's not an absolute requirement to vote. And those, of course, a non-citizen could get either of those documents, so it doesn't 100% necessarily prove citizenship. Again, this is just one of the differences between elections in the United States and elections in some European countries. Some of them have actual citizenship databases of everybody in the country who's a citizen. Everybody gets a nationwide citizenship ID. The United States, being that we have a federal system, we don't have that kind of thing.
Is there any evidence that non-citizen voting has affected election outcomes in Pennsylvania, or are election officials describing these as isolated cases?
Yeah, no, I've never seen any evidence that it affected an election. Of course, like I've said, sometimes they do get on the rolls. They might cast a vote here or there, but no evidence that it's happening in such a scale that it would affect even our smallest elections. I'm happy if somebody would show me that evidence. I'd definitely take a look at it. Just as you said, they say pretty much that, yes, it happens. They slip through the cracks. It's not entirely perfect, and we do what we can to look for them and remove them. But it's not happening at such a rate, election officials say, that it justifies the kind of restrictions that people want to put on the franchise, which would potentially endanger preventing more people to going from the polls than it would catch these people who shouldn't be at the polls.
Looking ahead to the 2026 midterms, what impact could this renewed focus on election fraud allegations have on election administration or voter confidence?
Yeah, well, I think the second part of what you said is the real danger. You know, election officials, there's been a lot of discussion and I think some concern on the left, like, are we going to have the midterms? Is Trump going to cancel them? Elections are absolutely going to happen. Your local election officials are going to do the job that they've done every year for the last decade of their lives, or however long they've been in that office. And you're going to be able to show up the polls. You're going to be able to vote. The real risk in things like these, not that the concerns that Trump isn't bringing up aren't things that need to be dealt with in their own due course. It's that the risk is that giving undue weight to these concerns that is not supported by how statistically significant they are actually works to undermine confidence in elections. Elections essentially are a trust-based exercise. It's how our society determines how we want to shape ourselves. And if people can't trust that system, then it defeats the entire purpose.
You're also reporting today on a new study showing student voter registration falling to its lowest level in years, and Pennsylvania ranking last among 18-year-olds voter registration rates. How significant is that decline?
Yeah, that was an unfortunate email to get in my inbox. I'm sure you know, as a reporter yourself, you get all these PR pitches in your inbox every day. And I saw that one pop up, and I was like, oh, man, well, that's not great news. This organization called the Civic Center has been focused on registering students. It's a nonpartisan organization. Their goal is just, to register youth, people who are 18 to 19. I think everybody knows that's a demographic that doesn't participate a lot in our elections. But I was surprised to see how low some of the rates were, especially here in Pennsylvania. They've only gathered data for 30 states so far, but Pennsylvania was at the very bottom of that list at 22% of our 18-year-olds registered to vote. And something that really struck me from the story, from the interviews I did, was the woman that runs that organization, Laura Brill. She said, there are other states that have much better rates, 40, 50%, Oregon's all the way up at 86%. And what she said to me really struck me was that, it's not that Pennsylvania youth are less motivated than voters in Michigan. It's that our systems are set up differently that makes it harder for them to access the voter registration process. Pennsylvania has some strict timelines on when somebody can register if they're not 18. And that makes it more difficult to capture that demographic of voter.
What are they saying is driving the drop? Is it a matter of lower enthusiasm or changes in registration practices or something else?
Yeah. So, for example, let's take Oregon and Pennsylvania. So Oregon, 86%, they can register youth at age 16, right? So that doesn't mean they can vote at 16, but it says once you turn 16, we can put your name on the list and your voter registration will be active at 18. That means you don't have to do anything else and you're ready to go when you turn 18. You can just start voting. Now, that matters because, most people don't actually think about elections until a couple of weeks before it, maybe even the week before the election. And at that point in most states, it's too late to register. So getting them on the rolls early prevents them from not being able to get on when they really need to. And the one reason the age 16 really matters, if you think about it, that's when most people are going to start interacting with their government. They're going to go to their DMV and get a driver's license. And in a lot of states, there is a process called automatic voter registration. When you go to get your driver's license or renew it, you can just be put on the rolls automatically, so long as you're qualified. But here in Pennsylvania, you can get your driver's license. We have automatic voter registration, but you can get your driver's license at 16 and a half. However, you're not eligible to vote or even pre-register when you're going to turn 18 before the election until you're about 17. So most of those, that age demographic is missing that automatic voter registration window if they're getting their license at 16, but they can't register until they're, 17 and three quarters.
Pennsylvania, often one of the nation's most closely watched swing states. What could lower registration among these college age voters mean for turnout and for future elections?
Yeah, well, obviously, we're missing an important voice among our electorate when we're not registering them. They have just as much of a right, lived experience to voice their opinion in our elections. So we're not getting them into that conversation. And of course, with only 22% of our eligible student or 18-year-old population registering, obviously our participation, our turnout would be a lot higher if we could get that up to 86% like Oregon. Now, of course, not all of that 86% is going to be voting, but there's obviously, I'm sure there's kids out there who say, oh, yeah, I want to go vote in 2024. And then they realize that the voter registration deadline was 2 weeks ago. And, even though they're turning 18 tomorrow, which is the day before the election, now they can't register. So they didn't get to participate. There are, I'm sure, folks like that with some policy changes would be allowed to participate.
Are schools, colleges, or other organizations changing how they approach voter registration in response to these trends?
Yeah, there are a lot of schools that they work really hard at registering their student population. There's an award called the Governor's Civic Engagement Award that's given to high schools that register 85% or more of their eligible students. And that's been what I've heard from schools is that's a great motivator for them to try to get as many students as possible registered. The tricky part comes with, again, our registration law. The law is that you can register if you're 17, if you're going to be turning 18 by the next election. So let's say you want to vote in the primary and your school holds some registration event. Okay, great. You can register and get your application in. But if you're not going to turn 18 until the summer and then the election, so because you want to vote in the election in November, well, you have to wait until after the primary election happens to register to vote. And that primary election is in the third week of May. Now, after that, most students are going to be worried about their final tests, going to college, summer break in general. So what organizers tell me is because of that timeline, it makes it harder to register that group of people who's turning 18 over the summer.
You know, these two stories seem to point in opposite directions. One's focusing on preventing ineligible voting, while the other highlights fewer eligible young people registering. What do you think that contrast tells us about the broader state of elections?
Well, what I think it says is just that elections are complicated in general. You know, we have a lot of different rules for a lot of different people, and everybody cares about elections, right? They care about making them secure or making sure as many people participate in them as possible. But when you get down to like the actual how they function, how do we identify these non-citizens? What implications do they have? What's the trade-off for making rules that would more narrowly target them? What is the trade-off if we expand pre-registering our students? The rules get really complicated when you drill down into them, and I think that's what's made changing the rules here in Pennsylvania so difficult is that they're not very straightforward, they're complicated, and you have to think about how they actually get implemented on the ground.
Just 105 days until the midterms. Besides these stories, are there other stories you're watching closely or other stories that Pennsylvania voters should be paying attention to?
Yeah, well, obviously, the top of our ticket this year in Pennsylvania will be our gubernatorial race. Josh Shapiro up for re-election against our state treasurer, Stacey Garrity. So I'm very interested in what both of their track records on election administration issues is, and I'm going to be taking a look at that here shortly.
That's Carter Walker with Vote Beat Pennsylvania, nonpartisan reporting on elections and voting. More information at votebeat.org/Pennsylvania. Carter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, a local resident who's about to tackle a 10-mile open water swim to raise $10,000. We'll hear how the fundraiser helps keep community programs free for children, teens, seniors, and families across the Upper Delaware region. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, Dartmouth College President Sion Bailock.
We're not a political organization. We're not a social advocacy organization. We have a very clear mission. And when people trust in that mission, they trust you.
Can universities win back our trust? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. One local resident is preparing to take on the biggest endurance challenge of her life, and she's doing it to help strengthen her community. On July 25th, Tustin Social Board member Jean Cogut will swim 10 miles across Vermont's Lake Oh, I didn't really preview this. Memphragog?
Memphremagog.
Thank you. As part of the Kingdom Swim, with the goal of raising $10,000 to support Tustin Social's free programs for children, teens, older adults, and families throughout the Upper Delaware River region. Joining us this morning are swimmer Jean Kogut and Tustin Social co-founder and board president Greta Knutson. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Hi, Tim.
Thank you for that pronouncer, Jean.
No problem.
Why did you choose a lake with a really hard name to pronounce?
Oh, my God. Well, it took me forever. Well, and there's a fictitious monster in the lake called Memphrey. So you can just call it Lake Memphrey.
This is not just a challenge of endurance. It's a challenge of, making sure you don't get the monster
to eat you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us what this means. Put it in perspective. I can't get my head around it. What does it actually mean in terms of time, preparation, and endurance to swim for 10 miles?
It's kind of like running a marathon or training for a marathon. It's just a little bit at a time. So at first, a two-hour swim seems like it's, wow, I could never swim for 2 hours. And then you do 2 hours and 15 minutes and 30 minutes. So you work your way up. I spend a lot of time in the pool. It's nutrition. It's enough protein. It's getting sleep. It's what people don't realize is that when you do a long swim like this, you have a dedicated kayaker, and that's my husband, Jay. So he will be kayaking alongside, but it's his job to stop me every half an hour. I brought a little sample pineapple pack with me today as a prop. But you have to eat and drink water every half hour to keep yourself going.
And are those some of the other things you have to prepare for in open water swimming versus swimming in a pool, like this constant need for rehydration and refueling?
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't have the same sense of being thirsty when you're in the open water. So someone has to remind you to drink, otherwise you get dehydrated. But yeah, and there's wind, there's currents, there's a lot of stuff in open water that you obviously don't experience in the pool.
Does knowing you're swimming for your community change the experience?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. This is, I think, my third swim for Tustin Social. And, I wish I could say it was all roses the whole time, that, oh, this is great, another stroke, Tustin Social. But it's more like, oh my God, I put this all over social media. Everyone knows I'm doing it. They all gave me money. Like, I don't have a choice. I have to finish. So it does really keep me going. And I think about all the people who support us and donate. And it feels like, as cheesy as this sounds, it really feels like everyone's in the water with me, because they're in my head the whole time.
It motivates you when you feel like physically you might want to stop.
It feels like I have a whole team behind me. So it's really great.
Greta, let's remind folks about Tustin Social and the role it plays in the Upper Delaware community.
Thank you. Yes. So we are just all in awe of Jean. Jean has been a founding board member since the beginning. We started back in 2023. We're a community funded and community nonprofit organization, and we exist to identify gaps in the social infrastructure in our community and surrounds. And we started with social programming. So we have youth programs, which is after-school programs for teens and for younger kids. And we have senior programs that we all call SAGE sessions. All those programs are free and accessible to everyone. And we rely on donations.
Well, and then they are free programs. You can't emphasize that enough. Why is it important that cost isn't a barrier to participation?
Well, I mean, I think one of the biggest issues is, the economic issues around, where we live. And I think having free programming just means that that's going to be accessible to everything that we do is accessible to everyone.
And what impact does a fundraiser like Jean's have on your ability to continue or expand those offerings?
Oh, it's just critical. Like as I say, we're all in awe, and we just cannot thank Jean enough for, I don't know, crazy impulse.
Like it's maybe
like it's you say we're all in the water with you. We're not. We're just near it and super supportive. But no, we couldn't. It's donations to support efforts like this and grants that keep us going. We wouldn't be able to keep our doors open otherwise.
But you've also called Jean's swim a reflection of what community is all about. What does it mean to have a board member willing to take on something this demanding for the organization?
Well, she sets the bar really damn high. So I don't know I'm tired by Thursday. I don't know what I'm going to be doing for swimming. So, But no, it's Jean has always, since the beginning, has embodied, you know, embodied what it means to show up for your community in the way that she, well, I mean, Jean is like, when I met you when you were working with the Youth Commission on July 4th, like she's been the treasurer for many organizations. She's kept the show on the road for many of the local organizations that we, you know, create and form our community. She always shows up and delivers. And so she's just an extreme, an incredible example of what it means to be a community member.
Jean, have you heard from community members who are inspired by your swims?
I think people mainly think I'm nuts. And I got to say, I'm far more comfortable. I would rather swim 25 miles than have to listen to people sing my praises. That is not my comfort zone. the community is just really fantastic. I know other people who with whom I've spoken about the swim. I train at Woodlock. I swim in the pool there. Mm. And some people will say, oh, I didn't know there was a pool there. That's so great to know. Maybe I'll start to swim there. And so there's a whole community of people here who swim in the Delaware and who swim at Woodlock, and we all kind of keep each other going too. So it's really cool. The more you throw something out there, you talk about a hobby or an interest, you find people with similar mindsets, and they exist, I think, in every community. But it's been really inspiring for me to meet other swimmers in our community.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned this is your third swim, and your husband is helping you in the kayak. What's the reaction been from your family and friends as you do this for a third time?
Well, I think people are surprised because the first two swims I did were in the Caribbean, much more comfortable, very
like,
shallow
we'll go
water.
With you.
Oh, and they have. We had a house full of people both times. So I think the reaction is, you're doing that same swim again. And I said, no, actually, this one is on the Canadian border and it's 10 miles. So it's kind of like.
And there's a monster in the lake.
Well, there's a monster in the lake. Yeah. So, but I have been working up. I did a 10K in the same lake in Vermont last year. So I haven't used this length swim before for the fundraiser. And people are. I think there's the shock value has worn off a little bit because I think for people who don't swim, a 2.5 mile swim is the same as a 10 mile. They just know it's a long swim. So, yeah, I think the length probably means more to me than it does to other people.
How long will you be in the water?
Oh, I swim about a 40 minute mile. So like 7 hours.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's like a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Oh, wow. So what do you think you'll be thinking about?
Oh, my gosh. Well, my husband's going to die of embarrassment. I often think about Def Leppard. It's my all-time favorite band. And so sometimes I'll be in hour 3 in the pool and I'm like, I'm just going to sing Photograph in my head over and over. So I sing songs to myself. I think about my friends. I think about my family. I think about my community. I really do, though. It's a conscious decision on my part that I think, okay, I just had my feed break. I go for another 40 minutes. I'm going to think about what renovations do I want to do on my house or like, how can I, what am I going to do when I get home or what do I have to do at work next week? So it really, as long as I focus on something different for each segment, it makes it go really fast.
You have to trick your mind into thinking of something else. Otherwise you just focus on the endurance part of it.
It's far more mental. I mean, and once you kind of hit your rhythm in the water, some people say, well, I could just swim forever, but it's more like, oh my gosh, what should I think about now? Because you're really alone with your thoughts.
Greta, if this fundraiser reaches its $10,000 goal, what will that make possible for Tustin Social over the coming year?
Well, thank you. No, we're about to go into the fall for our after-school programs. They'll begin again in September. So we have an after-school kid program, which is grades 2 to 6, and then we have a teen program, after-school teen program for grades 7 and up. And our senior program is called Sage Sessions, which will continue throughout the year. So the money from this fundraiser will go directly to support our programming.
And where can folks get more information if they want to support and follow along or, you know, provide words of encouragement?
There we have a GoFundMe site, which we have been posting on social media, and I should have had that ready, but Greta, it's a complicated number at the end, but we have been posting. Tustin Social has been posting. I've been posting personally, and also we have flyers up everywhere. So if anybody grocery shops around here or goes to the post office, there's a flyer with a QR code, and you can donate.
Yes, we. It's the GoFundMe. It's at GoFundMe.com, and it's just supporting Tustin Social's incredible work. So if you enter Gene Kogut, GoFundMe, and Tustin Social, you'll get straight
how
to
much,
the.
How much further do you have to go on the 10,000?
We're at 31,010 right now. All not right. Not that I'm counting. I could have said 3,000. So we're about a third of the way there. And so many people came up to me this weekend, yesterday, watching the World Cup final. Oh, yeah. I still have to donate. So please, it will be open until mid-August. But if people don't mind, I will be reminding you. If I saw you on the street and you said you plan to donate, you will be getting a text from me.
I will be following you. That is Gene Kogut and Greta Knudsen of Tustin Social. We're talking about the 10-mile swim to raise $10,000 for Tustin Social on Lake Murfgagurg. What is it again?
Lake Memframagog.
Thank you.
Yes.
Be careful of that monster. And also, just for some motivation, we're going to go out to help you on this.
Oh, my God.
Wonderful. Thank you, Tim.
And we'll take a break. Coming back to talk conservation, cocktails, and conversation. We'll hear from the Delaware Highlands Conservancy about that next. It's Radio Chatskill.
On the next Radiolab...
These are like swimming fossils.
Could one of the oldest and scariest species on our planet...
Sharks are crazy, yeah.
...help cure some of our worst diseases?
It blows your mind. It really does.
These animals that we don't even want to share the water with because we're afraid that they'll harm us could actually save us.
Wait, what?
It's amazing, actually.
That's on the next Radiolab. Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple. Free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
It's Radio Chatskill. Protecting the forests, farms, and waterways of the Upper Delaware takes more than conservation easements and stewardship. It also takes community engagement. This week, the Delaware Highlands Conservancy is inviting residents to gather for cocktails and conversation in Narrowsburg, an informal evening where people can meet Conservancy staff, learn about current conservation efforts, and discover ways to get involved in protecting the region's natural resources. Joining us now is Samantha Mango of Delaware Highlands Conservancy to tell us more. Samantha, hello.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being here. Tell us more about...
Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about Cocktails and Conversation. What's the idea behind this event, and who's it designed for?
Yeah, this is a Delaware Highlands Conservancy event, and it's a more casual event, sort of like a happy hour, to invite community members who might not be familiar with Delaware Highlands Conservancy out to a local establishment to enjoy some cocktails and conversation and to learn more about what we do about conservation and land protection in the Upper Delaware River region.
It's at La Sagone in Narrowsburg. Why did you want to have a community gathering, a conversation in a community gathering space rather than, you know, out in nature or at the preserve?
Yeah, we do a lot of programs at the reserve. We're located in Beach Lake over in Pennsylvania, but we do work on both sides of the river. So when we have these mixers, we try to be in places and meet community members both in Pennsylvania and New York. So Narrowsburg just made sense. It's literally right on the river. You can see what we are working to protect firsthand, and it's a great place.
Guests will hear from members of the Delaware Highlands Conservancy team about current conservation work. What are some of the biggest projects or priorities that Delaware Highlands Conservancy is focused on right now?
Yeah, our main mission is to conserve the forests, farmlands, clean water, and wildlife habitat in the Upper Delaware River region. And we primarily do that through conservation easements. And that has a whole plethora of things that go along into getting a conservation easement closed for a landowner. So we'll have Trey Talley, Lydia Freethy, and Steve Ghosh, all staff members from our team, there on Thursday to talk about what they do and how they do it.
You mentioned you work across New York and Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. What are some of the biggest conservation challenges facing the Upper Delaware region today?
Oh, there's a handful. I think the biggest thing is financial. So people who want to protect our land may not have the financial opportunity to do so, but there is grant funding opportunities. So connecting with our staff, talking about your land, if that's something that you're interested in protecting, we can look into if there's grant funding opportunities to make that happen.
A lot of people, when they hear land conservation, they assume it means locking land away from public use.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what conservation actually looks like in practice and how it actually benefits local communities?
Sure, yeah. The way that we do it, it's private land owners who want to conserve their land in perpetuity. So it doesn't mean the land becomes public, but it does mean the land becomes undevelopable. And that will be enforced forever. So every year we go out and our land stewardship team monitors all of our properties to make sure that there's been no development or there's been no, for example, like UTV tracks or maybe a timber theft. They go out to each property and make sure that nothing has changed and the land is still being conserved. And we do that every year for every property we have a conservation easement on.
How does protecting forests and farms and waterways affect everyday life for people who might not think of themselves as conservationists?
Yeah, the land is really important too. Of course, the air that we breathe, the food that is farmed in the area, all of our local fresh food, and the water that runs through the Delaware. So it's not just for us, although we get to benefit both with clean drinking water and for recreation opportunities. But it also helps everyone downstream from us. We support the drinking water in both New York City and Philadelphia.
And summer, of course, bringing thousands of visitors to the Upper Delaware region, you know, recreating in the area. And recreation and conservation can successfully coexist, right?
Sure, yeah.
And how do you think that folks who are coming up here to, you know, just, you know, play and have fun can learn about conservation? And how do you guys try to, you know, influence or show them what the conservation looks like in the area?
Yeah, I think firsthand conservation is really interesting. There's so many things that go into it, and there's so many different ways to participate in conservation. And especially with tourism, people who come up here for the summer to spend time in nature and to spend time on the water, they wouldn't have that opportunity if the land wasn't properly conserved. So sharing that information to have people learn about how we protect it and how they can get involved with protecting it is really important.
Tell folks about some of the educational programs, volunteer opportunities, and other community events that are available throughout the year and how important they are to your overall mission.
Yeah, beyond just the Cocktails and Conservation event in Narrowsburg on Thursday, we have a couple of great education programs coming up. We have a monitoring volunteer training on July 24th. That's from 1 to 5 p.m. And people who are interested in joining can join our stewardship staff. It's an informative training so they can learn more about monitoring our monitoring program and how they can volunteer to participate in annual visits to protected properties throughout the area. We also have a sunset wellness walk coming up on July 25th. That's from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And participants can come to our reserve over in Beach Lake, and that'll happen during sunset hour. It lasts for about an hour, hour and a half. And it's a walk through our meadow and wildflower trails, and you will get the most spectacular sunset view. Mm-hmm. And it's a really great opportunity if anyone is interested for photography.
Let's remind folks about the Cocktails and Conversation event on Thursday the 23rd. Where can they get more information? Do you need folks to register in advance or RSVP in advance?
Yes, registration in advance because space is limited. Tickets are only $10, and you can reserve your space at DelawareHighlands.org. When you register, that ticket includes a complimentary Prosecco or Rosé and complimentary appetizers.
You had me at Rosé. Before we go,
right?
Before we go, what's one thing that you wish people understood about conservation in the Upper Delaware River region? What's the thing that would have the most impact when it comes to fulfilling your mission?
Yeah, I think for me personally, it's not just something that affects us in our lifetime. It affects all of the future generations to come. So when you get involved, whether it's through protecting your land as a landowner or participating in Delaware Highlands Conservancy as a volunteer, all of our efforts really help all the future generations and really to protect this region that is so special and that we all love so much.
That's Samantha Mango of the Delaware Highlands Conservancy. Their Cocktails and Conversations event is coming up at La Sagon Narrowsburg on Thursday. More information and registration at DelawareHighlands.org. Samantha, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. But before we go, a reminder about that tornado that touched down in Hancock and also in Broome County. Village Mayor Sean Shannon has lifted the Village of Hancock's state of emergency, allowing travel to resume. But the town of Hancock remains under a state of emergency because of the extensive tree damage, down power lines that continue to make travel difficult. Thousands of folks still without power, according to NYSIG. And again, officials urging residents to use caution, avoid downed trees and damaged structures, never approach downed power lines as utility crews continue restoring access and electricity. And this message from the town of Hancock Emergency Management to rely on official sources with accurate, verified, and timely information. Rely on official sources for disaster response and recovery updates. The town of Hancock Emergency Management page will serve as one of the primary sources of official announcements, along with information released from county, state, federal emergency management partners. And we hope everybody in the Hancock and Broome County areas are safe. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville and at vintagehousejville.com. And from listeners like you.
Researchers estimate that tens of thousands have died in Africa due to cuts in U.S. foreign aid. In Nigeria, life-saving drugs once funded by USAID are now much harder to access.
It started like a normal sickness. He had fever, weakness, and was not eating well.
I'm Elsa Chang. We hear from Nigerian families who have been affected on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You know those best if used by or consume by labels on food? Well,
something like 20% of all food waste is attributed to confusion over date labels.
California recently banned most food expiration labeling. It's a huge change and one that forces the question of who decides the dates, how they choose, and whether they're needed at all. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, sunny and nice, a high of 79. Some clouds tonight, a low of 57. According to the National Weather Service, we're in for some more severe weather tomorrow and possibly into Wednesday. Showers and a heavy thunderstorm possible tomorrow afternoon and in the evening. Humid, high 73. Wednesday, 77 with a shower or thunderstorm possible. Looking ahead, it'll be sunny and nice through the weekend, less humid Thursday, sunny and nice through the weekend with highs in the mid to upper 70s. On Point is next.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care,
with Garnet Health Doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
Why are so many people caught in doom loops of sad or anxious thoughts? New research suggests it might be because their mental maps have stopped updating.
So you have this kind of recipe for, you know, turning on the sadness machine and then locking all the doors for other visitors that might interrupt sadness.
Fixing our mental maps this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.